Well, good morning, everybody. My goodness, it's good to see you. I'm thrilled that we're starting a series of messages today that we're calling Damaged Goods. You know, if there's anything I can be certain about, it's that anytime I speak to a group of people, I don't care who they are, everybody I'm speaking to has experienced pain or is presently dealing with some level of pain at some spot in their life. And most of us experience pain because of something about the past that cannot be changed. And that's what this series is about. We're calling it Damaged Goods. And it's, we're not focused on the damage. We're really focusing on the redeeming power that Jesus of Nazareth has to lift us and restore us and how we can experience that restoration in our own lives. So that's what we want to talk about over the next few weeks. I got a kick when they sent me the PowerPoint file by email a couple of days ago so that I could, you know, put some of the add-in illustrations that I use and that sort of thing. Somehow when they saved the file, it saved as DAM_GOOD. And that's what I'm hoping this series will be. Because we're talking about some really good stuff. I want to start today by talking to you on the theme of damaged but deliverable. And that title really comes from a chapter in a book by the late author and humorist Barbara Johnson in a great book, especially moms would enjoy reading, called Fresh Elastic for Stretched Out Moms. Moms, you ever feel like that? And she just shares out of some things in her own life experience. And she tells about one particular day when she was just reflecting on all of the things that had happened in her life up to that point. My goodness. Here's a lady, she had lost a son in Vietnam. She had a second son who was killed by a drunk driver. Her husband then went through a debilitating accident. And just recently, to the day that she describes this event, her third son came out to his parents that he was homosexual and chose to alienate himself from the family and remained estranged from the family for over a decade. And as she was just kind of thinking about all these things that seemed like they were just stacked against her, she was really, frankly, on the throes of a very promising pity party when all of a sudden the doorbell rang. And she went to the door, and a courier service was standing there with a box that she had ordered some teaching tapes from somebody, but the box was all smushed, and, I mean, the paper was torn, string was hanging off of it. Somebody had literally just wrapped strapping tape around it. And right on the top, it had these words, damaged in transit, but then two options, undeliverable or deliverable. And somebody in big black pen had underlined deliverable. And she said she stood there and she looked at that package and she said it was like God just spoke into her heart, damaged but deliverable. She goes on to write about the fact that many lives like her own are damaged and hurt. She says we should be marked fragile, handled with care, but we're like packages on a long, bumpy journey toward maturity. We've been crushed, but instead of being handled like fine china, we're slammed from one side to the other. And we get damaged in transit. We've been unraveled, unglued, undone. We're coming apart at the seams. We've been shoved against walls of despair and frustration and handled carelessly with no thought for the fragile heart inside. But she realized, but you know what? I belong to God. And I may be damaged, but I'm deliverable. I want to direct your attention to a story in the Gospels that's the main basis for what I want to talk with you about this morning, about the power of Christ. It's found in Matthew 12. If you want to open your Bibles to it or it's coming up on the screen, you can follow it there or pick up one of the Bibles nearby. You'll find it on page 896. That one day Jesus went into the synagogue, the place of worship, and there he saw a man who had a paralyzed hand. And we don't really know the situation here. The word paralyzed there literally means a shriveled or a useless hand. And in order to accuse him, they asked him, is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath? Now, just a word of background. Uppermost in the minds of most Jewish people in Jesus' day was what was permissible on the Sabbath day. It had become the most important observance among the Jews, this one day where you were to do no work. And they literally had hundreds of laws they slavishly paid attention to of what was work and what wasn't work. And so that's what's behind their question, because Jesus had the audacity to actually heal people on the Sabbath day. And the religious leaders said, well, you know, that's work, and you're not allowed to work on the Sabbath day. So that's what's behind their question. But he said to them, what man among you, if he had a sheep that fell into a pit on the Sabbath, wouldn't take hold of it and lift it out? A man is worth far more than a sheep. So it's lawful to do good on the Sabbath. And then he told the man, stretch out your hand. And so he stretched it out, and it was restored as good as the other. But the Pharisees went out and plotted against him how they might destroy him. And when Jesus became aware of this, he withdrew from there, but huge crowds followed him, and he healed them all. Notice those words. He healed them all. And he warned them not to make him known, so that what was spoken through the prophet Isaiah might be fulfilled. Here is my servant whom I have chosen, my beloved, in whom my soul delights. And I will put my spirit on him, and he will proclaim justice to the nations. He won't argue or shout. No one will hear his voice in the streets. He won't be a rabble-rouser, in other words, trying to lead revolution. He'll not break a bruised reed, and he'll not put out a smoldering wick until he has led justice to victory. I especially want you to focus on verse 20 there. He will not break a bruised reed and will not put out a smoldering wick until he's led justice to victory. And the nations will put their hope in his name. Now, frankly, we don't have background on this man with the withered hand, whether it was some sort of a deformity from birth or a disability that he lived with, whether it was atrophy from some disease process or perhaps some accident that caused him to be this way, but we know that he was damaged, and Jesus made him whole. Now, when we talk today about damaged goods, we're really talking about the damage that comes into people's lives. And I want to make a distinction here as we get started today. And when we assess the damage, what's it from? And there's kind of three different ideas here that I want you to think about with me, if you'll write these couple of things in. Number one, there are people whose lives are damaged and difficulty because they're paying what I call self-inflicted stupid tax. And do you know what I mean by that? I mean, my goodness, the difficulties have been brought on through foolish or bad choices where somebody is experiencing the consequences of decisions that they themselves have made. They're paying stupid tax. Let me give you an example of that. Coming up on the screen here, meet a guy named Todd Fansler. Todd lives in San Diego, and one day Todd found a rattlesnake in his backyard in a bush and decided to pick it up. And when he picked it up, it didn't strike, and so he decided he'd take a selfie with him holding this rattlesnake. And as he was trying to snap the selfie, the rattlesnake snapped him. And as a result, he almost lost his arm. I mean, I could show you a picture here, but some of you might lose your breakfast, so I won't do that. But I don't know if you can see the number that's on the bill that's there on the right side of the page. $153,000 hospital bill. $83,000 of it was for anti-venom pharmacy charges. You know what you call that? I better not say that because this goes out on the internet and I don't want to have a lawsuit. Proverbs 19:3. A man's folly ruins his life, and yet his heart rages against who? That's what you call misdirected anger, my friends. You see, as a result of their own foolishness or indiscipline or lack of self-control, people experience pain. But then there's a second category, and it's really two different kinds of people I want to talk about here, and that is some who are victims and what I will call the victimized. First of all, there are victims, people who experience things that are situations beyond their own control, a disaster that they're in, or some situation from birth, some accident not of their doing. But then there are the victimized, and they are the people who frankly, the damage in their life is because of the intentional cruelty or harshness or the evil of others. I think about people who are victimized by terrorists or by criminals or by at the hands of an abuser. Here's the thing God wants us to remember. The Lord is near the brokenhearted. You got to underline that statement. The Lord is near the brokenhearted. He saves those crushed in spirit. You may be damaged, my friend, but God cares about you. And it may feel like you've been left all alone and He's far away, but I want to tell you that He is near. In fact, I love how the Message paraphrase puts this. If your heart is broken, you'll find God right there. If you're kicked in the gut, He'll help you catch your breath. See, it's important for us to remember that He's not in the thing that hurts. He's always with those who are hurting. Always with those who hurt. And that's why I love in natural disasters, you know, the most common thing people will ask is, well, how could God allow a tornado or a hurricane or an earthquake or whatever to happen like that, an accident like that? But I love how always there are those who move around, those created in the image of God, because God Himself wants to put His arms around people who hurt. Now, one of the treats today is I want to share with you the story of a lady in our church called named T. Austin. T. is an ICU nurse here in Fresno. And recently she shared her story with us, and I actually want to use it in three different parts today because it's an incredible story. But I want you to see an example in this first part of what I'm talking about victims and the victimized. T. grew up in Oklahoma in a very conservative Christian family, and I'll let her pick it up from there. Watch the screen.
I really didn't fall in love until I was almost 27 years old. It was an unlikely relationship. A young man in our community was going through a difficult time. He had been left with three small children under the age of five. The baby was only 5 months old, and I just kind of stepped up as their normal babysitter to help him with the kids. We decided that we would not pursue a romantic relationship until he was through with his crisis and had his life together more. God used both of us in each other's lives to challenge each other. He would call me every morning with a daily challenge or a scripture, and we would pray together before we started our day. One morning, he didn't call, and I just assumed he probably got called into work. So I went about my day. On my way to work, I noticed that his car was still in the driveway. So I stopped just to see what was up, and he didn't answer the door, but I could hear his alarm clock still beeping. I found him shot to death in his bed. The love of my life and my very best friend on earth was taken from me in a heartbeat. After a week-long trial of testifying every single day, the people, the responsible, were both convicted, and I was left with what was a seemingly perfect life in shambles at my feet. I had a full future planned, and I really didn't know where I was going from that point. I wanted to be married. I wanted a family. I met a new guy coming to our church who began coming with a friend, and he was funny. He was the first person that made me laugh in a very long time when I honestly didn't know that I would ever laugh again. We started dating, and we ended up getting married after a relatively short dating time. It was less than 3 months into the relationship when I realized that I had really made a wrong decision. I became aware of a number of addictions that he was dealing with, and the fact that he was bipolar and not compliant with his medications. Honestly, I was so embarrassed that I had made such a bad mistake, and I felt the weight of the world as far as responsibility to not disappoint my family and not disappoint my church and not disappoint my community. I chose to walk away from the truth, and I began to hide and cover all of the things that were going wrong and do the best that I could to protect the illusion of my perfect life. And the further I walked away from truth, the more difficult my life became. Over a period of almost 12 years, his depression began to spiral out of control. He wouldn't seek help. He became more angry and more paranoid and more violent. In October of 2012, we were headed back from California from my birthday trip, and he had a complete psychotic breakdown. We sat in a hotel room. He sat near the door with a loaded gun. He took away my keys. He took away my phone. He was demanding answers, to which I had none. He was convinced that I was cheating or involved in a conspiracy to get him in trouble. I attempted to answer as honestly as I could, and he just spiraled out of control. I really felt like I would never live to see the light of day again. And I just began to pray, God, if you will get me through this situation and just get me safely home, I will take whatever difficult steps I need to take to make things right. I will walk away from this life that I've chosen, and I will do my best to return to you. And with God's grace, the next morning, I was able to convince him that we needed to go on home because I needed to go to work. We got back to Oklahoma only a few hours before I had to go to work. I went to work, and I texted him that I really wanted him to leave and go and stay with his uncle for a while. When I came home, he was loading his truck, and he asked if I was serious about him leaving. When I said yes, he began to hit and kick my car, and I turned and I drove away, knowing that my life would never be the same from that day on. I was afraid, but at the same time, I was almost relieved just because I was safe and away from danger. Our divorce was final only a few months later, but my life was not the same. The shame and the guilt and the disappointment that I felt, I was disappointed in myself. I felt like my entire family, my church family, my community was disappointed in me. And the shame was almost unbearable. I just couldn't stand to face anyone. I decided just to walk away. And I packed what would fit in my car, sold what I could, stored the rest, and walked away. I left and drove straight through to California and started a new job on Monday. I just wanted to build an island and be alone. I was disappointed in people. I was disappointed in myself. And I wanted just to go somewhere where nobody knew my name.
Well, you can see the kind of damage we're talking about here, can't you? You know, what's bad, though, is that sometimes people do things in their damagedness that just digs the hole deeper. In fact, I want to just lighten the mood here for a moment or so. I want to show you some ways in which people have done some really crazy fixes of things, thinking that somehow they'll make them better. I came across this the other day, and I was reminded of these. And, you know, I'm hoping that's a temporary fix for that guy, you know. Otherwise, that guy in the back, he better get paid a lot, that's all I can say. Aren't you glad God created duct tape? Oh, my goodness, the things that it can do. And this may be the same guy, I don't know. Hey, that's a pretty good job, and just watch that first step, though, okay? Now, this one is amazing to me. And if you know anything about how batteries work, I mean, you know, if that guy, the handle on that C-clamp vibrates just a little bit closer to that other battery post, you know, that guy's going to have a big surprise. Or how about this one? This was creative. I don't know if you're just supposed to put the hose up and sort of squirt gas through that little hole and just hope nobody walks by the parking lot where you're parked with smoking a cigarette, you know, that day, because you're in big trouble. This is one of my favorites right here. All right. You might be a redneck if, okay? I mean, he's even got his generator strapped on the back there, you know, and he's like this guy, you know, who's just decided, okay, that fixes it, you know, it's okay. And what I'm trying to say is that sometimes the fixes that we apply aren't very good. Can I mention four that are common that people do? Number one is just they chug more bitter beer. Now, do you know what I mean by that? Do you remember this commercial, this guy that's coming up on the screen, you know, who drinks, I don't remember, it's some beer thing, but he drinks bitter beer and he gets the bitter beer face, okay? And I'm not talking specifically here about people, I'm not speaking about alcohol so much as people who just keep consuming resentment and anger toward what's happened. You know, Hebrews 12 tells us, be careful none of you fails to respond to God's grace. For if he does, there can very easily, more easily than you realize, spring up within him, notice this, underline this, a bitter spirit, which is not only bad in itself, but it can poison the lives of other people. See, the reality is that bitterness, my friend, is a cancer. It's a tumor that will keep growing. It's a weed that will take over the whole garden if it's not pulled up. And our need is to know, how do we let go of those resentments? We're going to talk about that in this series. How do we get loosed from them? The second is people who just play the entitled victim card. And I probably don't even need to explain this, do I? Because you've met people like this. Somehow they think that they're entitled to special status or treatment, and they stand out, or they especially have convinced themselves they're entitled to their addictive or overreactive behaviors that have become extreme and excessive because they've been a victim. You know, I'll never forget being with a friend of mine named Roy one day. We were sitting at an In-N-Out Burger, and we were talking about this. George Bernard Shaw has a play where he talks about people who've become reduced to a selfish, feverish clod of grievances and ailments, complaining the world won't devote itself to making them happy. And we were talking about that reality. And he said, you know, Steve, I've been wanting to print up a bunch of t-shirts I just pull out and hand to people when I hear them whining. And he says, the t-shirt will just say, shut up, nobody cares. Now, I don't agree with him, because I know somebody does care, but I know the sentiment. In fact, somebody once said, hey, you need to be careful of complaining too much, because number one, about half the people who hear you complain think you probably deserve what you got anyway. You're paying stupid tax, and you owe it, and you should give your fair share. And the other half of people, frankly, think they got worse problems than you anyway, and so they could care less. What can easily happen is the third thing. People just spiral into dark places because of the damagedness in their lives. Hurts and disappointments cause them to spiral into a pit of despair. And it becomes a dark place. In fact, I want to show you something called the depressive triad, because this often happens. That people, and I don't know if it's, you know, what comes first, the chicken or the egg? Is it depression that leads people to think this way, or is it thinking this way that leads to depression? I won't have an arm wrestling contest over that because it's all wrapped up together. But people, you know, they disparage their situation. Oh, this is horrible. This is terrible. This never should have happened. I don't deserve this. So on and so forth. It's horrible. This is unacceptable. Then they diminish their future. You know what? Things will never be the same. And probably the future is never going to get any better. It won't be any better than this. And then they devalue themselves. What an idiot that I let this happen to me. Or, what's wrong with me that these things are coming in on me? There must be something horrible and terrible about me that this would descend on my life. I'm no good. It's called the depressive triad. And what's needed is to know how to get out of that spiral down, how to change the direction. We're going to talk about that over the next few weeks, of specifically how we do that. The fourth, T just mentioned in her life experience, and that is that we take a self-imposed exile, where frankly, we just wall off other people to keep the hurt out, because never again do we want to be hurt or disappointed or used by somebody else. But you see, it's as dangerous, the things you're walling out, it's what you wall in that can be just as dangerous for your life. The Beatles had it right in Hey Jude when they said, "Don't you know it's a fool who plays it cool by making his world a little colder when they've been hurt?" Proverbs 18:1 is an interesting verse. It says, "One who isolates himself," because that's what we're talking about here, going into solitary confinement and isolation. "One who isolates himself pursues selfish desires." Isn't that an interesting statement? "He rebels against all sound judgment." And what this means, selfish desires, is it means a self-concern. We pursue our self-interest. Very easily we can get into self-pity or self-protection or self-focus, or begin to live with the lie that I can be self-sufficient. I just don't need other people. And the Bible says that's not true. Our Creator said it's not good for you to be in isolation. James 5:16, in fact, tells us, "Confess to one another, therefore, your faults." I like how the Amplified Bible explains the meaning of that word, your slips, your false steps, your offenses, your sins. Confess those to one another. Pray also for one another that you may be healed and what? And restored. Now notice the one another's there. Something happens when we decide to start opening up to other people. My friend Rick Warren says it this way, "The revealing of your feeling is the beginning of your healing." And I want to go back to T's story now here for a few moments, and I want you to watch the screen, and I want you to listen to how things began to turn for her. Watch the screen again, if you will.
"I had one friend who simply wouldn't take no for an answer. She continued to probe and ask questions about my past and my history and what brought me here. And over a period of about 2 years, she began to work her way in onto my island that I had created for myself. And one day she called me and said, 'I'm coming over.' And I was like, 'What do you mean you're coming over?' She's like, 'I'm coming over. It's time for you to get your little introvert self out of the house and we're gonna go eat lunch.' It formed almost an instant bond of relationship just because she was determined to show me that I was worth it. And she said, 'I don't know what has happened and why you're so broken, but you are not who you think you are and you deserve a life, and it's time for us to find one.' I had made a new commitment to God that Christmas, when I spent Christmas alone, that maybe I needed to start back to church, and maybe I needed people more than I thought I did. So we went hiking a few times. One morning she said, 'Let's go hiking on Sunday.' And I told her, 'Well, I can't go until after church.' And she said, 'Well, what time is church?' And I said, 'Well, I'll go to the 8:00 service.' And she's like, 'Okay, I'll go with you.' She loved it. She started going with me on a regular basis. God was really doing some really good things in our lives. At Core 201, Pastor Shane was teaching, and the last point that he mentioned was being involved in community and small group. I was not up for that. In fact, I met him after service and I said, 'You know, I'm really good with the attendance. I'm okay with the giving, with the prayer, with the Bible study, but I'm not down with the whole small group. I don't trust people. My heart has been broken, and I don't want anything to do with a small group.' He listened to me and smiled, and he said, 'Can I pray for you?' And he prayed the most beautiful prayer that God would restore my faith in humanity and restore my faith in God and give me a love for people. He was so sincere about it, and he told me, 'Promise me one thing, that you'll give this small group a try.' He's like, 'I've assigned you to a group that's going to be led by Dan and Shauna Kevorkian, and you're going to love them. It's a safe place.' The first night, I was so pleasantly surprised. I knew when I walked into their home that I was welcome and that I was loved. I will never forget the first time that I met Shauna, and she wrapped her arms around me, and it felt real. for the first time in a very long time, somebody wrapped their arms around me and it felt real. I knew that God was there and I knew that God was doing something big. I remember crying all the way home and I told Karen, that was really good. Like way better than I ever thought it was going to be. God might have something going here. My third week of small group, I received a text from her like at 7:30 in the evening. It said, I love you, T. I was like, aw, I love you too. I thought she was just missing me because I'd been in Oklahoma for a few days. About 2 hours later, my phone rang and it was her husband, Todd. And he said, honey, I have some really bad news. Karen has taken her own life. I can't even... I can't even describe to you the pain and the dismay and the absolute profound sadness that enveloped my heart. I really, I was completely lost and broken. And I began to cry. And I cried for almost 2 weeks, almost nonstop. God had placed my small group as like a divine safety net. If I hadn't met my small group prior to that, I would have had no one to turn to. And they encouraged me to seek professional counseling. Karen's death was a deep enough wound to make me realize I was suffering from what my counselor called accumulated grief. All of these things that I just hadn't dealt with. Randy's death that I just pushed aside and moved on. My divorce and the whole years of trauma that I just pushed aside and moved on. You can move away from those things, but until you move through those things, they don't go away. And for the first time, I was able to leave all of that brokenness at his feet because I couldn't deal with it on my own. And when I realized that I had been trying for so long to earn his love and to earn his grace, and all the time it was ready just for me to be received.
And don't you appreciate T opening up her story to us like that? My goodness. Friends, let's finish up here. You know, in this story that we've read today, a man went to the place of worship, and I don't know if he knew that Jesus of Nazareth would be there or not. Likely he didn't. But I'll tell you for one thing for sure that I know he didn't know. He had no idea that he'd go home so different than he walked in. If you will, he had met the match for his damaged life. And what I want to say to you is, Jesus Christ, when you come face to face with him, you've met your match. I don't care what your pain is, or how it got there, or how the brokenness came in your life. Jesus can make the difference. And there are four truths here. Would you just write these down and we'll be done this morning. We'll cover these quickly. Number one, Jesus flows gentle kindness into our painful brokenness. Oh, my goodness. This verse that we read, he will not break a bruised reed. You know what this is talking about? In the Middle East, marsh reeds grow, kind of like our tules here in the Central Valley, around lakes and rivers and so forth. But they'll grow almost 16 feet tall, and when they fully age, they're hard like bamboo. And they're used mainly for constructing buildings and thatched roofs and so forth. But something can happen in the early stages of those reeds that if it's a breezy, too windy of a day, it can bend them. And if they break, if they get bruised, they'll never be able to be used with the strength that they were intended to have. But what this is emphasizing about Jesus is he won't give up on a bruised reed. He won't give up on that which is broken. He knows how to make it whole. You know, when I drive on campus, I drive past a tree every Sunday that I come to church, which is a lot of Sundays. And this is my favorite tree on campus. And the reason for that is because a few years ago, a guy who worked on our staff, that tree, when it was very young, the prevailing winds, it was kind of leaning to the east. And he decided, you know what I'll do is I'll straighten that up and then we'll stake it so that it can grow straight. So he put a chain around it and he hooked it to his truck. And as he was pulling it back up straight, all of a sudden he pulled it too far and snap. And then, you know, he felt like a total doofus for doing that. But you know what? We just kind of left that tree alone. And today you go out there and, man, it's got new life growing out of where it was broken. And I love that because to me it's a parable I drive past every day of what God is doing in this church. How Jesus knows how to just flow gentle kindness into our painful brokenness. A man named Eugene O'Neill once said it this way, we're all born broken. We live by mending, and God's grace is the glue. 1 Peter 5, that's why it says, God resists the proud, but he gives grace to the humble. So humble yourselves under God's strong hand. Circle the word strong. See, you've been subjected to harsh hands and selfish hands and cruel hands and violent hands, perhaps. But here's a strong, loving, gracious hand. And in his own good time, he will lift you up. And that's not saying in his own sweet time. Now it's saying that just at the right time, he knows how to begin to lift you and put you back on your feet again. You can throw the whole weight of your anxieties on him, for you're his personal concern. That's why, you see, God often uses the painful experiences, just like he did with T, to open us up to our need for something outside of ourselves. That's why Jesus in the Beatitudes, and I love how the Message paraphrase puts this, you're blessed when you're at the end of your rope. With less of you, there's more of God and his rule. You're blessed when you feel you've lost what is most dear to you. Only then can you be embraced by the one most dear to you. One time I heard a sermon, and I'd be honest, I don't remember much about the sermon itself, but I'll never forget the title. It was entitled, How God Becomes Father When We Cry Uncle. And friends, there are some of you right now, God has you on your knees, and that's a good place to be. Number two, Jesus breathes life into smoldering things again. That's what this text that we've read tells us, that he will not put out a smoldering wick. This is talking about, you know, little lamps that were used, and as they began to run out of olive oil, they'd begin to smolder out and lose their source of fuel, or maybe the wick itself began as it got to the end. And what it's saying about Jesus Christ is that Jesus, see, how do you breathe life back into something smoldering? You just blow on it, just very gently. And as you do, it fans back into flame. And you see, what this is telling us is that Jesus knows how that which is weak and the one with faltering strength, the one who is struggling, and maybe for you today, it might be a dying marriage or an alienated relationship or dimming dreams in your life. But Jesus knows how to blow his life back into it and revive it. Nothing's too great for his power. That's why I love, it says that when they began to reject him, Jesus went out, huge crowds followed him, and you notice those words, he healed them all. Here's a passage on your notes from Matthew 15 where large crowds came and they brought, you know, the listing there, the lame, the blind, the deformed, those unable to speak, and many others, and they put him at his feet. That's the best thing you can do with your brokenness. It's put it at the feet of the one who is able. And it says that he healed them. By the way, are you familiar with that term triage? It's a medical term. Like if you ever used to watch MASH, and all of a sudden they get all of these incoming casualties, and in triage you decide, first of all, there's some people they're just beyond saving, so we're not even going to give our efforts. Then there are other people, well, they're wounded, they're hurt, but you know what? We can put them off and their life won't be threatened. But then they're the ones who right now we need to get them into surgery. And so you triage to determine who's hopeless and who can wait and who do we need to pay attention. You know what I love about this passage? Nobody got triaged by Jesus Christ. There are no hopeless causes for him. That's why he said, everyone the Father gives me will come to me, and the one who comes to me, I will never cast out. Nobody's hopeless. Because a bruised reed, he won't break. A smoldering wick, he'll bring it back into life. You know, today it's become real popular to do something called repurposing. You know what I'm talking about? It's where you take objects that had one purpose and they've gotten old and you repurpose them to make them new. So, you know, here's a cool idea of a cheese grater that now is holding pencils, or there's an old rake that was rusted off from the thing and now it's holding kitchen implements, and here's an old ladder that was beyond use, and some of you say, hey, man, I'm writing that down. I'm going to go home and do that at my house. Here's my favorite one right here. Here's just an old suitcase. Somebody made that into a bathroom mirror. Now, you know, what's really funny is these things, they were ready for the landfill. They had no value, but they got repurposed. And suddenly they have value. I want you to listen now to the last, just about 2 minutes long of a segment where T talks about what's happened in her life. Watch one more time the screen.
God has started something miraculous in my life. The first month after Karen's death, I had 11 visitors go to church with me. And honestly, I didn't invite any of them. I really wasn't in the mood for inviting people, but God just kept sending people into my life that would say, I'll go with you. Okay. And as they came along beside me to walk through this most difficult time, I have found some of the most amazing friendships and the most amazing relationships. Once you begin to share your story in safe places, the power of that shame that the enemy tries to use against you just begins to fade. If you're going through any type of grief or brokenness or even shame from your past, there's nothing you can do to make God love you more, and there's nothing that you've done that can ever make Him love you less. I have absolutely no idea where I'm going from here. But for the first time in my life, I really don't care. Because as long as God is guiding this trip, I'm up for the journey. And I'm excited about the future. I'm excited about what God has for the future. And I have hope. In spite of all the pain and all the shame, He has given me hope for the future. And no matter what your story is or where you're coming from, there is hope for your future. There's no way to explain the absolute gratitude in my heart for what God is doing in my life in spite of my actions. And it's almost like an elaborate rescue mission that I feel like He's launched just for me, that He goes out of His way to make me know that I am loved and that I am cared for and that it doesn't matter what mistakes I've made, it doesn't change His love for me. That's the beauty of it. There's no earning. You can't be good enough to deserve it. And you can't be bad enough for Him to reject you.
I'll write this down. We're almost done here. Jesus takes us alive with His greatest of all loves. He takes us alive. That's how He takes prisoners. He takes us alive. I like how one person put it. He surrounds us with His love and forces us to surrender. You know, I love something T just said. It's like she said, He launched a personal mission to rescue me. Friends, that's not only true for her, but it's true for you. In His great love, He came to this earth to lay down His life on a cross to give us all that we need. And when we know His love, what a difference it makes. In fact, I want to show you something real quick before we move on to the conclusion here. A moment ago, I showed you the depressive triad. I want to show you what I call an impressive triad. It's three lasting values called faith and hope and love, and it's amazing how they are the antidote to the depressive triad. Because when I start to disparage or think poorly of my situation, you see, when Jesus Christ begins to pour His faith into my life, I start realizing that, you know what? Nothing's too difficult for him. That's why the bigger your God, the smaller your problem. And we begin to diminish our future when we're in depressive situations and we think it's going to be terrible. But Jesus Christ, on the basis of faith, begins to bring hope alive. We start seeing there's possibilities. And instead of devaluing ourselves, we become secure in His great love. Ephesians 3, 17 to 19 tells us, Christ will make His home in your hearts as you trust in Him. You see, friends, that's what He wants to do, but you've got to open your heart to Him. And maybe the sense of pain has brought you to that point of realizing, I've got to open to Christ. Your roots will grow into God's love and keep you strong. You'll start growing. And may you have the power to understand, as all God's people should, how wide and long and high and deep His love is. May you experience the love of Christ, though it's too great to understand fully. And then you'll be made complete with all the fullness of the life and power that comes from God. See, here's the fourth thing I want to say, if you'll write this down. Jesus never leaves us where He finds us, my friend. Barbara Johnson, if I could just return to her thoughts just for a moment. She said, you know what? Even though we may be damaged in transit, we're still deliverable. We're on that long trip, and our final destination is the heavenly city. And someday we will rejoice around the throne of God, and the Master will claim me and fix me all up, and I will withstand the shocks of life, and God will claim His package. My label may be torn off, but my destination is clearly marked glory. Now, I don't know what your past might be, but I know what God wants to do. He wants you to turn from it, learn from it, launch from it, and guess what? Then you can begin to even lead from it. You got to turn away from those things that are wrong. And then you learn from the pain in your life. If you fall down, pick up something, for crying out loud. And then you begin to launch into new directions that God has for your life, just like He had for T. And you know what happens? Then you begin to lead other people. This last verse, that's what it says, that He comforts us in all of our troubles and all of our affliction, all of our pain, so that we may be able to comfort those who are in any affliction with the same comfort He's given us. Listen, God comforts you not to make you comfortable, but to teach you to be a comforter. And God can use you. He can take the mess of your life and give you a message where you'll actually be able to inspire and lead others out of your pain, just like T. Austin has inspired us and has led us today. How cool is that? Damaged, but deliverable. Bow with me for a word of prayer, will you? God, thank You for the chance to look into these great truths again today. God, I pray for those who are here who their steps toward You they need to take. There's new choices they need to begin. I pray that You'd help them to do that. Teach us over these weeks as we focus on these things that we'd become strong and true and grow and live to the glory You've had in mind our lives should have. And as our heads are bowed, if you're here and you've never opened your life to Christ, do it now. Open your heart to Him. Let Him come in. Just say, Jesus Christ, I need You in my life. I turn away from all that I've done that's wrong, and I want to follow You. I want to live for You. Help me. Help me to know You, to know what I need to do next better. Thank You for hearing my prayer right here and right now today. Amen.